Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Just trying to experiment with something here to put the person who's on Skype on the screen behind me, but unfortunately I can't see the screen as it's behind me, so I can't really control the Skype, and if I click on anything during the Skype call, it kind of unfull screen. So it's a bit of a pain in the ass, so let's see what we can do about that. Now, I have no idea who my guest is, what his name is, or anything like that, because we just got him like in the last two and a half minutes. Whatever your name is, welcome to the program.
Why, thank you. My name is Bill Clinton, and I was the former president of the... No, this is Scotty Roberts, and do you want me to just tell you a little bit about what I do and who I am?
That's kind of how we normally start the show.
All right. Well, let me hold to your tradition then. Scott Roberts... I am an author and let's see, where do we even begin? I've got two books out with New Page Books, a third that I am part of an anthology with, and have a new book coming out with them this October. And I've written the titles The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim, The Secret History of the Reptilians, Lost Civilizations, and the new one coming out is The Exodus Reality, which is a bit of a diversion from all of that other stuff, but still one of those earth mysteries, historical mysteries. My background, I had Bible college seminary training, 30 years ago, and I've kind of drifted away from that for various reasons, yet still open to spiritualities and different kinds of thought. And that kind of brings me to where I am now. I've spent the last 30 years in advertising as a creative director, art director, and a writer, and there you go. That's about the long and short of it.
All right. Okay. Well, what would you like to talk about today? Apparently, you don't have like a new book out or something, do you?
I have a new book coming out. We can mention I'm the publisher of Intrepid Magazine, and we launched that about 2 years ago. We're in our third year. I was the editor-in-chief of Taps Paramag for about a year and a half prior to that, the Ghost Hunters from Sci-Fi's official rag. And I left that outfit and launched Intrepid Magazine, where we do all different kinds of topics, ranging from, we like to say, we are eclectically focused on science, politics, metaphysics, ufology, ancient aliens, paleo contact, metaphysics, all of those kinds of things. And basically, the magazine, I launched it to be the things that I like. And so that's what we pursue. And we have a big symposium we do every fall. Every fall, that's kind of a misnomer. That's like saying your second year is your annual event. Maybe we'll be annual in a few years. But right now we're doing the second Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis, St. Paul in October. With last year we had Eric Von Daniken, all the talking heads from Ancient Aliens, a bunch of authors that you'd recognize. Same kind of thing this year. You can go to paradigmsymposium.com and see what that's all about. The new book that I've written, as I mentioned, this is a book that's a bit of a deviation from some of the things that I've written about in the past. My first book with New Page was The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. That one's obvious, exploring all the mythologies and the different stories around a race interrupted very early on in human history. And then I wrote The Secret History of the Reptilians to follow that up. It's really an examination of all of the mythology that goes into that whole, you know, you've heard it. You've heard the reptilian stories. There's an alien race. They were reptilians. They came to this planet. They subjugated humans, lost some war with the earthbound terrestrial reptilian race, and now they're in the background trying to regain control of the planet and humanity. They're even behind the Illuminati. So, as it's all said. So I examine all of that mythology. The new book is one. And of course, as soon as a book hits, if you're writing constantly, this is what happened to me. When The Secret History of the Reptilians came out in February, it had been 6-7 months since I had written that book, finished it, and launched into this new effort on the Exodus reality. And so when people are calling you to interview about that book, your head's so in the new thing that you're like, yeah, I wrote that thing in the Reptilians, but let me talk about my new book. That's kind of where my head is. We just finished in April the Exodus reality, and it's an examination of Moses, the historical character. Did he or did he not exist? The Exodus, and I've co-authored this with a very good friend of mine, Dr. John Ward. He is a British archaeologist that lives in Luxor, Egypt. And we were over in Egypt back in January, February, going on expedition looking for Moses and the characters around him. And it's not a Bible book. You're not going to find it in a Bible bookstore. Well, you might until they read it. Then they're like, oh, we got to get that off our shelves. Because while it's got biblical elements in it, the Bible for us is a source document. And we go into lots of other things other than biblical history. And so the Exodus reality, it's subtitled, see if I can remember it. It's pretty easy. Unearthing the Real Moses, Identifying the Pharaohs, and Examining the Exodus. So that's coming out. And that, to me, is a fascinating topic. People ask me, you know, what do you have invested in a biblical topic like this? To me, whether it's a biblical topic, a Hindu topic, whatever topic you might want to put on, or religion or culture, it is a historical mystery to me. And I want to know about it. I want to know things. I want to know, is there anything real connected to this? Or is it all mythology? Was it all legend? Did Moses look like Charlton Heston and wear a red and black striped robe and part the waters of the Red Sea with his staff? You know, and those are things that you can't get into all the spiritualities and find any kind of historical documentation. But believe it or not, there's a hell of a lot of historical documentation, secondhand archaeological information that really supports the plausibility of the story.
So just recently, I'm not sure if it was actually that recent, but they found some chariot wheels and so on and so forth in the Red Sea. You've heard about that?
I have. And I thought that I had recently heard that somebody said that it wasn't a chariot wheel, that it was a gear on some kind of piece of machinery that from either a sunken ship or a truck or something like that. I don't know about that precisely. I think there is a website out there. And as a matter of fact, I had that photograph in my first book on the Nephilim. And the reason it was in there, the reason I talked about Moses at all in that book was the word Nephilim is sourced in the Hebrew Bible in a book that Moses was purported to have written. And so I gave a little background. What would he have brought to the table? Why is he writing about this, and why is there any credence in his version of the story compared to the 600 other cultural stories that are out there? And I posted that picture in talking about the Exodus very briefly and said they've even found chariot wheels. Now, you never know on this stuff, because people come up with that, and then they also have debunkers that will come up with their version of what that is. And then you find out later, well, the debunkers were really wrong, or the original story was, and you never really know until you get down there, put on a mask and a tank and a scuba gear and go down and look at it yourself, which I haven't done. But I will say this, where they locate that chariot wheel is at a little pinch on the Red Sea, one of the narrow portions as you go up. If you know the map of the area, and don't you love that when people go, like when you go to anybody who's from Michigan, you know, Michigan is shaped like a hand and we're up in the thumb in Detroit. So it's like that. It's you've got the two, you got the Red Sea that comes up and then the two northern prongs, the Gulf of Aqaba and the northern part of the Red Sea. And they say it's up in this upper region where they crossed the Red Sea. There's an old pillar there commemorating it and all of this. And this is where they find the chariot wheels. However, there is one of those translation problems in the Old Testament where the Red Sea is really was mistranslated Red Sea when they meant Reed Sea or Sea of Reeds, which is in the northern portion above the tip of the Red Sea. It's where the Suez Canal is today. And it was all wetlands, and it went into these wet, shallow lake areas up there. And they believe that the path that the Israelites would have taken out of Egypt went around one of these lakes and through the wetlands. And there's even it's a natural historical thing that this region can have winds that blow, and it dries up the ground, and you can cross on virtually dry ground, and then the waters, the tides come in and close it back up. And if you look at the biblical account, it talks about how Moses, it said he stretched the rod over the sea and a strong east wind blew all night and parted the waters. That's what it's, and then the water stood as a wall on the left and a wall on the right. And you wonder how much of that is embellishment on true events to make this.
In Iraq, I spoke to this archaeologist, Jonathan Gray, and he's one of the people who actually has put on a tank and gone down and seen those wheels and so on and so forth. And in Iraq, in villages where they don't have any power for refrigeration, what they do is they put out water on the ground out in between these two walls kind of thing. And in the night, on nights where there's strong winds, the winds will come in and they will actually blow and they will actually freeze that water. And they use it for refrigeration of meats and so on and so forth. And what Jonathan contests is that there was a this wind got kicked up and it was so super cold that it actually did, in fact, freeze over the water and allow them to walk across, or at least that's what his account suggests.
That's interesting. There's all kinds of theories that you can put forth on these things, mostly because there's no way to prove it either way. So we have all these theorizings that go on about how this happened. And, you know, when we theorize all these different things, we're obviously looking to see if there's a natural explanation for what the biblical scripture talks about as being a supernatural event. And
well, that's actually what Jonathan Gray said. He said this is what they do in Iraq is a natural phenomenon for refrigeration, but what happened on the Red Sea was completely unnatural. Like, you know, it's got a physical basis in it, but there's no possibility that it happened just naturally alone. He said that there was some kind of divine intervention going on. Or at least
sure.
That's his.
Well, and that's what, you know, when you talk to somebody, is your friend Muslim?
No, he's Christian.
Oh, okay. I know that when I was in Egypt and I was talking to a good friend of my friend, who I wrote the book with, he was Muslim, and I talked to several Muslim gentlemen who are inspectors of like the Karnak Temple. One of them is the director of antiquities for all of Egypt, for all of the Sinai. And we talked to these guys about these things, and he was more, that second one, he was a little more liberal in his thinking, but the first guy was, and the friend, they were all, they talk about this and they theorize with this. Then they'd get very quiet and they'd say, well, as it says in the Quran, you know, and he kind of puts up his hands and bows his head and gets a little quiet. And I asked this friend, and I was meaning no disrespect to him, but I said to him, what would you do? How would you react if you found out that the things that you believed on a religious or a spiritual level were somehow controverted by historical evidence? What if you found out that, say, that didn't happen that way, that it happened this way? And I said, I'm not challenging your faith. I'm just asking, how would you deal with that on a personal level? And he just simply went, he kind of waved his hand and looked down and he said, it's as it is written in the Quran. And that was his take on it. And so I think there's some fear with a lot of people of in whatever religion you're part of. If you believe these things, there's that fear of disengaging yourself from it. I was very Christian, evangelical, thoroughly conservative, fundamentalist Baptist. And when I went to seminary and I was in youth ministry and I was even back then, I was a little on the edge because I didn't buy the whole conservative fundamentalist line. And the further I got away from it, the more I had problems with church polity and church methodology. I had problems with interpretation of certain scripture, with extra biblical stuff, as we called it, thrown in there. You have to live your life this way by this grocery list in order to be righteous in God's eyes. And I said, I disagree with that. Then in the writing of these books, between the Nephilim and the Reptilian book, I remember sitting back in this very chair and I'm staring at the ceiling and I'm saying, God, who are you anymore anyway? Because it has changed. My study and my research have shown that you are either very much bigger than I had always been taught or you're very much smaller than I had been taught. And so those are the things that you contend with when you start looking at trying to find answers to things that make sense outside of a biblical, you must believe this just simply because it is written mode. And it challenges your faith. My faith was challenged by writing these books. Some of it brought back around by some of the things in the Exodus reality. Some of them even more pushed further away, trying to decide if the story is accurate as it's told in the Bible or if it's... Here's the conclusions we came up with, is that, you remember, the Old Testament was rewritten or recompiled, reconfigured, or to use a J.J. Abrams word, it was reimagined. By the 72 rabbis in between the 4th and the 6th centuries B.C., under the invitation, I think the kind of forced invitation, they kept writing letters and saying, invite us, invite us, invite us. The invitation by Ptolemy II, the Greek pharaoh of Egypt at that time, invited these 72 rabbis to come into the Library of Alexandria and recompile the works of the Hebrew people. And there was a reason for this. If you follow the biblical chronology, Israel had been sacked by Babylon and carried off into captivity. Who wasn't killed or left his old people just and handicapped or whatever, just living in the ruins, they carried everybody and marched them off to Babylon. They were in captivity for a couple hundred years.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you go friggin' nuts. In fact, apparently that offends some people, the lighter side of genocide. You know what's even more offensive than a phrase called the lighter side of genocide? Is scumbaggery. You know? There's quite considerable quantities of scumbaggery out there, I think. And, you know, many whistleblowers and people who are decent men in an indecent time, to coin the phrase of Harvey Two-Face in The Dark Knight, that's really offensive to me, you know, getting locked up because you've reported a crime, having all your money taken off you because you won't bow down to corrupt scumbags. You know, that's really offensive. Think of a lot more offensive than the lighter side of genocide, but hey, maybe. Maybe I should just change the catchphrase so that a whole bunch of really soft people won't get offended by it, you know, so that when we talk about huge, massive pedophile rings and things like that that are coming to take your kids and weaponized vaccines and DNA-based bioweapons to specifically target any political dissident that they want, if they get a sample of your DNA, you won't be quite so scared or offended because... I mean, come on. Come on. Grow up. Are you over 18? You over 18? Okay, good. Thank you very much. Try and be a little bit mature about this. I mean, we're under FCC regulations. We can't swear. But I do like to push the limits for frack's sake, because I can't deal with this Shiite Muslim. Now, my very special guest is Scotty Roberts. Welcome back. And I was also very interested to hear your backstory there about how you kind of got into all of this, you know, going through the seminary and sort of disagreeing with a lot of the things that are going down there. And also your magazine that you mentioned sounds an awful lot like this magazine out of New Zealand called the Uncensored magazine.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Are you familiar with it, are you?
I'm vaguely familiar with it by sight and name only. I've never cracked a cover, not for any offensive reason, just never had one in my hands.
Well, you know, it happens, and it's really difficult to get them overseas. If not nigh on impossible, because they get confiscated by Homeland Security at the border. I'm joking, by the way.
We're gonna have to remove that from your luggage, sir.
Yeah.
Oh no, you. Exposing contaminated vaccines here, oh, that's a threat to national security.
What's national security again? Oh, yeah, that's right, making sure the state is secure by ensuring that all the people are slaves.
Oh, hell yeah. I think the founding fathers over here would be rolling over in their graves right now. So
I think they'd be rolling up something just to, you know, pass the time and deal with the stress.
Yeah.
Watching the nation just burn. And now, there's something I wanted to say. Spirituality and religion seem to be mutually exclusive. That's something that John Eisen from Uncensored told me a long time ago, and it's only rung truer and truer as time has gone on for me, as my spirituality has started to grow stronger, whereas my belief in religions has started to wane somewhat.
Yes, that's pretty typical. I think that's very typical, especially of our generation. And I'm only lumping you into my generation. I'm sure I've got good 20, 25 years on you. But what I mean by that is the current mindset nowadays, the people living now, more so with your generation than from mine, is that we are drifting further and further away from those traditional values. Or those traditional foundations that were ground into us. And we may come full circle, but I think most of us have gotten to that point of saying, don't tell me what to believe. Let me discover what to believe. If you tell me what to believe, I may not believe it. I may not end up being there. It's like, how many kids do you see who follow exactly in their parents' footsteps politically? Generally, the next generation wants to go, I don't want to have anything to do with that because that was dad's politics. I'm going to do my own thing.
Obviously, you've never heard of the Bush family.
well, that's a little different. That's a little different. When you've got I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but when you have a dynastic family like that, that's the kind of stuff that's going to happen. Look at the Kennedys, the same thing. How many conservative Kennedys are out there? You know, how many Kennedy children got locked in the closet until they swore they would be liberals the rest of their lives?
I thought it was locked in the closet until they masturbate and reveal their sexual past.
Well, there might be a little bit of that, too.
So. The other element is also dynasties seem to be, I don't know, there's like certain levels of them, like doctors, for example. Father's a doctor, son's a doctor, grandchild doctor, so on and so forth.
Police
and in New Zealand, in New Zealand, the lawyers and judges and everything like that, like most of them are actually like related, you know, by at least first cousin. Like the majority, I think. I forget the statistic. It's something ridiculous. Like there's 160 odd high court justices, and like 120 of them are first cousins or something like that. It's really freaky.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's kind of like that's almost like the Levites in the biblical Hebrews. The tribe of Levi were the priestly class, and they were the one that carried out all the dirty work and all of that. So,
also inventors of the pants known as jeans.
Oh, there you go. Yes, absolutely. Which I happen to be wearing. So,
I happen to be wearing jean shorts.
Oh,
the suit with a suit jacket on, but of course,
what's your temperature like over there?
You know, it's getting warmer because I have a heater going, but in general, it's not that toasty.
You know, it's summer here. I'm in Wisconsin, just a few miles from the Minnesota border. Minnesota considered to be the icebox of the United States, and but which is a misnomer. In the wintertime, yes, it can get 30 and 40 degrees Fahrenheit below zero. But that's for a couple of weeks at a shot. Then you go into the summer months. We've already had up into the hundreds with very high dew points and humidities. It's damn near subtropical here sometimes. So you get the flip side of the seasons up here, which has nothing to do with anything else other than to say our weather is wacky, too.
Yeah, I remember something Lewis Black said about Minnesota winter. He says he was watching a weather report, and he says, it's 20 below. That is not weather. That's an emergency condition. And if you had any brains, you'd call the federal government and say, get us the frack out of here.
Yes, please send choppers. Yeah, it can get kind of dire in the winter here, but you know we have that wonderful thing called indoor heat, and we've got snowplows. I got to tell you, it snows here. This last winter, it would snow, and within 2 hours of snowing, the streets were clear because you know if you had 2 feet of snow dumped on you, it'd be clear. So you know the infrastructure is here to live in this climate, I guess. So, and we're not quite frozen Arctic tundra yet. You still have to go a few hours north to hit that.
So. How many hours sunlight do you get a day during the day?
Well, we actually get pretty good hours of sunlight. Our sun, in the middle of summer at the equinox, sun will come up about 4:30 in the morning, and it won't set until almost 10 o'clock at night. Mm. So now the winter, it's a little different. You know, sun comes up at 7:30 in the morning and sets at 4:30 in the afternoon. So that's almost like, you know, you start thinking of that movie 30 Days of Dark.
30 so. Days of Night.
Night, that's what it was.
It's funny you should mention that because I was just thinking about that movie before getting on the radio today. And I was thinking, incidentally, what John Eisen from Uncensored told me about this. He actually yelled at me on the phone this one time when I told him me and the girlfriend were about to watch that movie. He's like, it opens up dark places in your mind, man. Don't watch horrors. Watch a comedy, man. Watch a comedy.
Nice.
You know. It was actually quite interesting that you should say that. I was just recalling why I'm never going to live in a cold climate for as long as I live, because I already did. You know, like you may have indoor heating, but in Dunedin they kind of don't. And even if you try, I don't know how the Scottish build houses. Like there's a Scots that settled down there, and they go. You know, they settled in Auckland and it's like subtropical, and they're like, you know what, it's not quite cold enough. Let's go further south. And they go further south and it's freaking freezing and it's got driving rain and it's cold as frack and it's absolutely horrible. And they're like, you know, I think we've gone just far enough. It sounds, feels just like home.
You know, lassie, unload the goats. We're home.
yeah. And there's a song like, Hey, you get off of my cloud, and it's Scottish. It's a hey, McLeod, get off of my you, and what I'm recalling is that I watched my olive oil freeze at room temperature. So people who you know live in cold climates with their central heating and all of that kind of stuff, and they go, "Oh man, it's really really cold here." They don't actually know what real cold actually is, and because that's the question I ask anybody. You know, "Oh, I've experienced cold, man. It's not that right, really." Have you seen your olive oil freeze at room temperature?
Now, what do you burn if you don't have indoor heat? What do you do? Do you dig up sod and burn dried sod in the winter? What do you do for heat?
Well, we had a really bad mold problem in our bathroom, and we asked our landlord to come and see about it, right? And he lives just across the road, so he came over about 5 months later, And he said, "Oh no, there's no problem here." He just rips off a big chunk of this wall that he just kind of like painted over, and it's just all black mold there. He's like, and we're like asking him for a dehumidifier, and he goes, "Oh mate, well it is pretty bad. I'll get you a dryer." So he gets. And there was only one power plug left in the house, so we closed off all the doors. Like the hallway was actually a smaller room because we had these real high ceilings and these really large rooms, like impossible to heat. So if you closed off all the doors in the hallway and then put the dryer there, it had no outlet or anything, so all the hot air would come out of the dryer. So we just put two seats next to the dryer, right at the rear of the flat, and just kind of huddle in our sleeping bags next to it for a lot of time.
And how did you spend your winter vacation?
Hey, but we did try and go skiing down the street when it snowed. It snowed once when we were down there, we got maybe about 30 minutes sunshine, like right in the very, very early morning per day on our house. We were just on the wrong side of the street kind of thing. And the snow was still there 6 months later.
Oh, nice. That reminds me of a very bad joke I can't tell you, so I don't even know why I mentioned it.
Bad joke. The Canadian hitchhiker, he's hitchhiking. It's a blizzard, and it's real snowy. It's real cold. And a trucker comes up and pulls up beside him to grabs his hand to pull him into the truck. And the hitchhiker's thumb snaps off.
Oh, that's cold.
Yeah, that's cold, man.
The one I was thinking of was, and I could probably say it because it sells on the bookshelves. It's Drew Carey's big penis jokes. Mm-hmm. And he had a joke about snow. And he was talking about, you got your finger on the button? Just in case. He said something about, mine is so big. He said, there's still snow on the end of it in July. So there you go. That's all that reminded me of. I know that's about as academic as I get today. So.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, seeing as we've been talking completely off topic, the reptilian side of thing, I was wondering, because I had somebody, one of my listeners tell me yesterday that I can shove David Icke up my ass and I'm spineless because I won't expose him or anything like that. What's your take on David Icke? Because I just think, you know, he's if the New World Order wanted to control people, why in the hell would they use somebody like David Icke to do so? I mean, he's exposing the planned agenda and all of that kind of thing. He's working directly counter to whatever their goals are, if that was the case.
Well, it's interesting. I wrote a bit about David Icke in my book on the reptilians, and I think I have successfully lopped off any possibility of ever having a live interview with him after writing that stuff. I say, David Icke, just look at the man and say, if there's a guy that wants to go out there and teach his new age teachings and get people excited about, you know, expanding your soul and becoming something wonderful and all of this, more power to him. Who cares? I have other things to do, but if that's what he teaches, then more power to him. But when he lapses over into this fringe teaching of these reptilian entities that live here on the planet trying to take us over, that all these famous personages are actually reptilians in cloned human skin. You know, the Queen Mum is obviously a reptilian. And, when you start getting into that stuff, you start getting into areas where you're either one of three things. You either really believe it and you're kind of a nut job. Two, you don't believe it at all, and you're just putting stuff out there to sell books and to get people interested in hearing you speak because you're tapping into that psychological need that people have to know that there might be or to think there might be something else. Or three, he's somewhere in the middle there, that there might be something to what he's saying, but there's no way to really know because there's no way to quantify or qualify any of it. You've got a lot
like
of people
like bacteria, for example. There was a theory of bacteria long before they had microscopes able to observe it.
Well, very true. Because we can't observe these characters because we can't. Have you seen the famous now famous Jesse Ventura interview with David Icke.
Oh, yeah.
I love that where Jesse looks at him and says, I just want you to answer my question. You know, and Icke is, oh, I don't think I have to come across that. You know, and you have this, rah, 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 you know, and then David Icke walks off. And because what Jesse Ventura was accusing him of was just doing things to make money. This is all a money-making thing for you then, right?
Right. He gave up his BBC broadcasting career in order to make money. Right.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think a guy that puts forward the things that he's put forward might not have been already seen in broadcasting by those in power going, I think this guy is this guy's a little tainted in the head, do you think? Before he even got there. Because to do the things he's done, the phases he went through, and all the junk that he's done and put forward, even, you know, 20, 25 years ago, you don't go from being, you know, news broadcaster, sports broadcaster, you know, and so-and-so kicked a goal today, you know, to I'm wearing all turquoise today. This is my turquoise stage because this is the way I get power. I'm a son of God. And, you know, you don't lapse into that overnight unless you've made it up or you're edging your way there ever slowly but surely. I've got
you've had some kind of really profound experience. Like, I remember when I was in Dunedin, I got busted for selling cannabis. And I previously believed entirely in the system. I actually told the police, yes, I've been selling weed for about 8 months at university, about an ounce a week and that kind of thing. And it was only after I found out that even despite my confessions and everything like that, they still made up evidence that I completely did a switch around. The entire system suddenly came into aware, and I became a completely different person overnight.
Now, you changed ideology. Let me ask, did you start doing odd things? Did you start claiming odd spiritualities? Did you start, or by odd, I mean
different? Absolutely. When I was in the cells, I tried to make myself a stone. You know, like I put myself into the lotus position, which I'd never done. And the pain and the fear and the horror of being in there. Like, this is the first time I'd ever been arrested. And I hope nobody ever goes through this thing that I've experienced. It's kind of half of the reason that I do what I do. I just wanted to make myself a stone so that I wouldn't feel what I was feeling, and I transitioned into this solid state where I didn't blink for what must have been about 40 minutes. You know, like I'd completely changed. There was something completely different about me. I'd utterly detached myself from reality. So, you know, I can experience, I've experienced these kind of really deep, profound suffering and pain and things like that. And that can change anybody.
Well, certainly. And of course, there's a load of questions that come behind that, but that's a great segue into talking about something that comes to mind, something I wrote about in the Exodus Reality about Moses. When we talk about the burning bush and that whole experience that he had, keep in mind, Moses was thoroughly Egyptian when he left Egypt. Then he went and married the daughter of a pagan high priest there in Midian, and he spent another 40 years in the Sinaitic religions, the Canaanite religions, the Sumerian religions. And it wasn't until that what he writes as being this experience of seeing God in a burning bush that changed his life forever. And he had his spiritual epiphany. The big question, however, behind it is this. He's the guy who said he saw it. He was the one who wrote about it. Nobody else was there. Nobody else saw God in a burning bush. And this was his story. And this is what, but this is what drove him to do what he was doing. So in order for him to go back to Egypt, at least by the biblical story, there had to be a huge motivation because he wasn't about to do that at age 80 years old. But he moves to do that. And yet you see that these people did not connect with him. You look at even the story when they go to Mount Sinai and Moses goes up in the mountain to get the tablets and all of this. There's actually in the vernacular, if you read the text, go back to the Hebrew and look at it in the vernacular, that's where they come to Aaron and they say, where's this guy, Moses? That's in essence what they're saying. They say, where is this man, Moses, who let us out? We don't know who he is. We don't know where he is. He went up into this mountain, build us a god, and they build the golden calf. And these are not a people who were Jehovah worshipers. They were not a people who were Israelites by anything but blood. They were all thoroughly Egyptianized. They built an Egyptian god.
How exactly did they get a gold foundry out there in the middle of the desert is what I want to know.
Well, now, what's very interesting, there's a couple of things. First of all, I believe that there's a little mountain that John Ward and I went and climbed up in the Sinai. It's not the traditional Mount Sinai site. It's a little place called Serebit El-Khadim. And we were the guests of Sheikh Barakat there, and he put us up in a tattered Bedouin tent on the desert sand overnight. There we are in the middle of the Sinai desert, the wilderness, with nothing there. And we're out there in this little tent, and we climb this mountain the next morning. And up on the top of this mountain, there's an old temple that's been in ruins for over 3,000 years, the Temple of Hathor. And Hathor was the calf or the cow goddess of Egypt. And around this temple site, in all the mountains and all the craggy plateaus around there, this was the mining capital of Egypt. This is where they were mining, you know, mostly turquoise and copper. But this was a big mining station there. And so when they would have visited this mountain, that would have been an operational site with this memorial and this sanctuary up on top of this little mountain. Also on top of that, you've got the biblical text says that the night before the Exodus, the day after the Passover with the plague of the firstborn and all this, that the Israelites went and it says, and borrowed all the gold and riches from their Egyptian neighbors. Now, I think that's a little under-embellished. They didn't borrow anything. It means they sacked Egypt, and they took all their gold with them. And so this is what they had. Everybody surrendered this gold that they had taken from Egypt. They plundered Egypt. That's what it says. And this is why I think, by the way, you don't have much mention of this in Egyptian documentation. You look at big temple walls and chiseled inscriptions of these great pharaohs and these monuments. There's not a single one of those pharaohs that's going to say, yeah, and this slave caste we had, they kicked my ass, and they stole all our gold, and they pillaged our country. You know, that's not what they did. They built themselves up. These were memorials to their great deeds. So you're not going to see that stuff inscribed. You are going to find other telltale signs, though. But I think, you know, Moses was like you in that jail cell, probably to a certain extent. I don't know what circumstances, after being 40 years there, led him into that, but something gave him an epiphany, and it changed who he was. And nobody else around him, I think, really deeply believed in his epiphany. And it's very evident by the way they acted. You know, they're always complaining. Oh, you took us out here in the desert to die. Weren't there enough graves in Egypt, they ask him. You know, hey, there were leeks and onions by the Nile over there. What do we got here? We got dirt. You know, and this is the way they were talking to him. This is the guy. This was not the great lawgiver to them. This was like now. And remember, it was a whole generation had to die off before they accepted the teachings of Moses and his successor.
As Obi-Wan said, who's the bigger fool, the fool or the fool who follows him?
There you go. There you go. And so they all followed him into the desert. And there's an interesting thing. In my book on the Nephilim, I write this chapter about Moses, and I call him the Pharaoh God of Israel. As you remember, the pharaohs, they were brothers to the gods, and they were gods themselves. They were deified. And in order to lead those people, I think Moses took on the persona of a pharaoh. He equated himself with God far too many times. And sometimes it's very obscure. There's something you'll notice in the writings. It says it's in the book of, I think it's later in Exodus or early in Numbers, the book. And it talks about how Moses pitched his tent outside the camp, and the pillar of cloud would descend on his tent, and there God would meet him and talk to him face to face as a man would talk to his friend. And then 9 verses later, in the same chapter, Moses says, but no man can see God's face and live. So what was he saying in that great contradiction? He was saying, no man can see God's face and live, but God talks to me face to face as a man talks to his friend. You know what he was doing? He was thoroughly Egyptianized. He was raised in the palace. The man who I believe he was had 92 royal titles bestowed on him. One of them was Grand Vizier. The other one was the hereditary crown prince of Egypt. And if he was in any way, shape, or form aligning himself for the throne of Egypt, he would have been considered a brother to the gods. And this is what he brought to the table to rule these people, because this is what they understood. And so he was equating himself. And I believe, I'll just give you it's like going to the last chapter in the book here. I believe that Moses was a man named Senenmut in Egyptian history, mid-18th dynasty. Mid-1500s, 1400s BC, 18th dynasty. He was the grand vizier to Hatshepsut, the female pharaoh. He was in the line of pharaohs, Tutmosis I, Tutmosis II, Tutmosis III. This is the guy who I believe he was. Now, the name Senenmut was the name given to him by Hatshepsut, who I believe was the young princess who found him in the Nile. She bore the title Pharaoh's daughter in real history. She was the daughter of Tutmosis I. And I believe when she found him, it says of Senenmut, all we know about in history about him is that he was born of commoners, and that he was raised to this lofty status, given these 92 royal titles, Grand Vizier, which is one step off of the Pharaoh's throne. But his name, Senenmut, means mother's brother. It meant, I, Hatshepsut, your mother, am elevating you to the status of brother with me to the gods.
Which gave rise in modern times to the phrase, a brother from another mother.
A brother from another mother. Exactly. Those Egyptians did some wacky things when it came to it. And, you know, this woman who I believe is the same woman who found him, and we claim as his, we, by the biblical stories, this is the mother who raised him in Egypt. I don't think she raised him as a mother. I think she raised him from mother's brother to that status, because there is a lot of theorizing that Senenmut and Hatshepsut were actually lovers. If you get in mind the
so they were a brother from another mother, something.
I mean, Egypt was like that. She was married to her brother, who died off early because he was kind of sickly. Go figure. But they left. They didn't have a child that was an heir. She had a daughter with Tutmosis II, and that daughter Senenmut was the tutor to her. And he was, and tutors, keep in mind, were not wet behind the ears school marms. They were usually military commanders, officials of great status. They were the pharaonic tutors to the children. Well,
wasn't it Aristotle and some of those great philosophers back in Greece? They were tutors as well, weren't they?
I believe so. Off the top of my head, I'd have to go reference it. You know, I like what Einstein said. Einstein said, "I never bother to remember anything I can look up." So. I figure I'm not forgetful. I'm not an idiot. I'm just a genius. So,
yeah.
I'd have to go look that one up just to verify that fact, but I think you were correct.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Alexander of Macedonia, commonly known as Alexander the Great, was tutored by one of the great philosophers. I forget which one it was. It was that name escapes me. Somebody will probably...
That guy with the robes, you know, the beard.
Which comprises about 80% of all known philosophers.
Right, that's like, you know, except, in my younger days...
In modern times, they not only have the robes and the beards, but they also have a moth-eaten cardigan.
There it is, an Argyle socks. But, you know, in my younger days, I was an entertainer at the local Renaissance Festival. And I would always invariably bump into somebody who said, "Oh, you worked at the Renaissance Festival? Do you know Joe so-and-so? You know, he's the guy with the long hair and the goatee." And I'm like, "You've just described about 80 guys to me out at the Renaissance Festival." So Moses, you know, the guy with the beard, you know, the beard, the...
Birds
the
of role. A feather, eh? Birds of a
yes,
feather.
Yes.
That's the interesting part about history, is it all kind of goes in a circle. And, you know, it just occurs to me, you know, some people want a revolution, you know, today, because look, everything's upside down. Okay, so the medical industry kills people, the politicians threaten
kill people.
Yeah. The police kill people. You know, like, these are the ones that are supposed to keep people healthy and happy and safe and so on and so forth. And people say, oh, that in order to solve this terrible problem, we need to have a revolution. What does revolution mean? Let's have a look. Ah, revolution. Have you ever been on in your car and it's got RPM, revolutions per minute?
Yep.
Okay. That's what it means. You're going in a freaking circle.
I always hail back to Thomas Jefferson, one of our founders here, who in part wrote the Constitution of the United States. He said, this nation will not long survive without a little bloody revolution every now and then. And it was more a lighthearted type of statement. He was one that's saying revolution is constant. You constantly have to be revising. You constantly have to be changing things in order to keep up with the times and the growing needs of things. Now, I'm a purist. I'm one that in the United States, I believe the Constitution is the Constitution. I almost used a foul language word. You can use the word Frank or Shiite Muslim. You don't Shiite Muslim with it, and that's just taboo. And to change the Constitution, you need to have a really good idea or a really good reason for it, and it needs to be well thought out. You don't do it willy nilly, just because we're part of the 99% and we want to rebel against that evil 1%. I mean, what a bunch
I find it really funny how 1% of the people do 99% of the work. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.